Welcome to Kidlit Happy Hour. Grab a drink, cozy up,
and explore storytelling with creative minds inside children's publishing and beyond.
Hey, y'all. It's Joanna. Caroline couldn't join us today, but we have a really special guest. Before we get to the guest, I just wanted to share with everyone that Caroline's book was released last week. She did an amazing event. And if you still haven't pre-ordered her beautiful book, Where is Poppy? Please run to the store. Get that thing now. It is such a gorgeous book about family and love and grief and memory and the ways that our loved ones stayed with us even after they're no longer with us. And it's just beautifully illustrated. Please go pre-order it. All right, on to our guest.
Who are you and who's with me today?
Hi, I'm Raina Telgemeier.
Raina Telgemeier. I have never heard that name in Kidlit. Tell us about yourself, please.
All right. I'm a graphic novelist and I have written several memoirs, including Smile and Sisters and Guts and a few fiction projects. And I also adapted The Babysitter's Club into graphic novels once upon a time.
Amongst many other things.
I just tell people I'm a cartoonist.
She says graphic novelist. Like she invented the genre. So here we are. What are we doing, Raina?
It's like super rainy out, but we've been trying to find a way to hang out for the past couple of weeks. And so we chose the rainiest day of the season for me to drive over here, which meant crossing the bridge.
I know, she drove so far.
It was actually super sunny and it was coming through like the rain clouds.
True. So was it pretty?
Yeah, it's like God rays coming down when you're surrounded by the water.
Because you were coming to my house.
Oh, yeah. You drive west and that's just what happens. Yeah, no, we've just been hanging out.
We've literally just been sitting on the couch and talking and drinking tea and eating snacks for like 4 hours.
Which is what people do when they come to my house also.
Yeah, it's been the best.
It's the best.
I'm really happy.
It felt like a true Sunday afternoon, which I don't actually give myself permission to take Sunday afternoons that often. But
what do you usually do on Sunday afternoons?
I usually sit at my computer telling myself, okay, I'm going to get some work done now. And then somehow that same amount of hours goes by.
And you're just staring at your computer.
Well, I should get up and like do the dishes. Or, I guess I should, make some more tea. And maybe the next cup of tea will inspire the writing to come out of my fingertips. And I don't really know what I'm doing in that time, but something happens. And
the writing does or does not happen.
So
usually,
wouldn't it be better for me to just take that time off, right? And say, this is a Sunday afternoon. I'm not going to try to work.
Do you give yourself time off ever during the week where you're like, this is dedicated rest time?
I do actually take that time every day.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I like a slow morning. So I like to be able to wake up slowly and roll out of bed. And then, I don't know, it's just like the routine of feed the cats and then eat breakfast and then drink tea. Mm. And the tea routine for me, it's important. I like to sit there and really savor it.
Like, do you read while you're drinking tea or are you just like staring at the wall and contemplating life with your tea and cats?
My smoking jacket and my slippers. Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like. I am reading something most of the time, but I've been really into playing Legend of Zelda for the last few months. So my friend Tin and your friend Tin Fam, gave me a copy of the new Legend of Zelda game last May for my birthday. And I was like, cool, I will get to this game when I'm finished penciling my book, which I spent all of last year doing.
What book is this? Can we just talk about that really fast?
I can't tell you what darn it is. I'm sorry that you don't get to.
But y'all, there's a new Raina book. It's top secret. We will know about it eventually.
They haven't announced it yet.
Oh, they haven't. Oh, okay.
It's going to be worth it when they do, though. It's a really awesome book.
What's a Raina book? Of course, it's really awesome.
I'm excited about it. But I was like, no, I don't want to get sucked into awesome video game times until I'm done with my book. So I finished penciling at the end of November and went on a trip and like brought my Switch on the trip and like loaded the game and was like, let's check out this Zelda thing and see what I think. Maybe this will pass the time on this flight that I'm on. That was 3 months ago. I've been playing a lot of Zelda and I have the like sore fingers and the back ache to prove it.
That's amazing.
So there have been several like
that's
Saturday.
Your daily rest.
It's usually what I do at the end of the day.
Okay. That's instead of like your wind down.
My wind down. Just get real like into fighting monsters and then sweating because I can't defeat the boss. And then I go to bed.
You go to bed and like fume about it.
I dream in Zelda. Do you play video games?
No, I don't. I feel like I was really into a Nintendo, like the OG Nintendo.
OG.
Super Nintendo, I was still good. And then everything after that was too advanced for me.
Mm-hmm, same.
And then I never did it ever again.
I've been an Animal Crossing fan.
Oh, see, I didn't do any of that. I had a very short Candy Crush stint.
Oh.
And then that's it. I get bored and then I'm like, meh.
There's certain games that are good for when you're on an airplane and need to kill 20 minutes or you're standing in line. For a while, I was like, I'm not a video game person. I just play this game on my phone. And now I'm like, I own a Switch and I'm clearly obsessed.
Thanks,
with...
Tin. Bam.
So I tell him this every time I see him. I'm like, thank you. It was a really good present.
It's just sucked up all my time. Okay, really fast.
Yeah.
You said you've been thinking about writing. Tell us more about what that means.
It means procrastinating at my computer for 4 hours
all
on a Sunday. Yeah. No, I've been thinking a lot about what I want my next product to be. And it's one of those rare times when I don't have an answer perfectly ready for me to chase it. So the freedom to sit and let my mind wander a little bit has been nice. And I'm actually at the point as of yesterday where I'm ready to pick up a pen and start doodling.
Ooh.
There's the whole like idea phase, which can sometimes take years just to let things germinate. So I've been sort of like list making.
Is this an idea that's been germinating for a year? More than years?
I think so.
Yeah, even when you didn't know.
I'm never quite sure until until I pick up that pen and start actually doodling or thumbnailing or whatever form it ends up taking. And it might go nowhere, but I don't tend to really start chasing ideas until they're pen to paper. So it's been a while since I've done pen to paper.
Okay, basically what I'm hearing is Raina is going to be a guest on our podcast sometime in the future. So I have so many questions for her, but I told her because Caroline's not here and she happened to be coming over, she very kindly jumped in and pinch as our guest intro person. But now my brain is like, I have 10,000 questions I want to ask you, but I will save them.
Okay.
Is there anything you can tell us about what is coming up for you that we can keep our eyes out for?
I can tell you a little bit. That laugh was so good. I do have a project coming out later this year called Facing Feelings. I did a big big retrospective art show last year with the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library, which is just what it sounds like, a cartoon and comics library. It's in Columbus, Ohio. And they did a big retrospective show with me over the summer. And the contents of that are being collected into like a catalog, I guess. But it's also just, I mean, it's like work from my childhood and work from my high school days and some of my early mini comics and stuff. And so they're all being collected and it's all annotated.
So cool.
It's been my chance to basically create an art book of my history. And this is also kind of what I talk about when I'm on stage presenting to kids. Like, this is the work I did when I was a kid. And this is the first comics that I made look like this. So all of that will be there. There are a couple of essays.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's been a really fun project to put together. And the show in Ohio was called Facing Feelings because it was all about kind of the emotions in my work.
I was like, facing your feelings?
Yeah.
Is that what it's about? Okay.
You got it. They chose a good title.
Yeah.
And so that's also the title of the book. Oh, so it's called Facing Feelings, The Art of Raina Telgemeier. And Scholastic is publishing that. It comes out, I believe, in October of this year.
Okay.
So a few more months.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That sounds amazing. Yeah. It's basically Raina's life through her art.
Basically.
With notes and annotations from Raina. Like a diary.
It's going to be dense. That's I have a lot of thoughts.
That's so cool. So tonight while we were sitting on my couch, I did pull out my son's comics.
They're really good, by the way. And I'm not just giving lip service.
And I show them to her. But I save all their stuff from school in these file folders and these, you know, boxes. So now, just in case he becomes a Raina or my daughter, I better save them all so they can make a book too.
Yeah, my parents did that. Oh, so that's why I have like so cool stuff that I can send you have that. Now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Raina. We're all obsessed with you because you're the queen. The episode today is with Lil Miss Hot Mess, who is on the board of Drag Queen Story Hour. They are wonderful. And the one thing I want to note is that we film a lot of these episodes many months in advance. And the time that I filmed this episode, I was in a hospital in Seattle. I think we've talked about some previous episodes with Frankie, but I was filming it from the hospital where my cousin was being treated for an emergency situation. On that note, this is a really amazing episode with so many brilliant insights from Lil Miss Hot Mess. So enjoy.
Okay, perfect. Well, welcome. Welcome. It is so wonderful to have you here. I'm just going to embarrass you for a second and do a little bio. So Lil Miss Hot Mess is a world-renowned drag queen, visual artist, storyteller, and a children's author. She has appeared on stages like SF MoMA, Stanford University, Saturday Night Live, and many more. She loves packing her performances full of political satire and technology to help illuminate what a hot mess the world can be. She has created two of the most, I can personally attest, deliciously engaging picture books we own. The hips on the drag queen go swish, swish, swish. And If You're a Drag Queen and You Know It, both illustrated by Olga de Dios. I have more videos on my phone that I can count of my kids swishing and shimmying and yes.
Oh, please. I love that.
And she is also on the board of the ever important and impactful Drag Queen Story Hour. Her writing has been published in NBC News, Salon, Wired, and Slate, among others. And if all that was not enough, Lil Miss Hot Mess is also a professor at the University of Arizona. We are so grateful to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Okay, we're at a happy hour, as we've established.
Yes.
Please, pray tell, what did you bring with you today to sip on during our conversation?
Well, my happy hour starting less than an hour after I woke up, because I'm a little bit of a night owl. So I am drinking a Spindrift mint green iced tea, you know, a little bubbly, a little fruity, you know, just like me.
Perfect. Oh, I love that. Okay. For the analogy.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, thank you. And welcome to both you and your Spindrift. So we want to dive right in and just start without any prefacing. How do you, Lil Miss Hot Mess, polish a story?
You know, I polish a story kind of similarly to how I polish performances, how I polish other projects, other writing. It always starts, I would say, for me with the kernel of an idea, which is sometimes an image, sometimes it's a phrase, and it kind of builds from there. Of course, when you said polish, I immediately think of nail polish. And so I sort of think about that layering process. You kind of have that initial inspiration of like, oh, I want this color, or I want this kind of look. And then you build these layers. Each one adds a little bit more strength and clarity. Maybe you get a little bit of, you know, sparkle at the end. But for my two children's books so far, I mean, they really started as songs that I would sing with kids at drag story hours. The first one came when I was thinking about ways to make those story hours more engaging and how to teach kids a little bit more about drag and who drag queens are without being so didactic about it. And so the kernel of that idea really happened, I forget if it was on the subway or in a taxi, but like literally on the way to an event, just popped into my head and got to play with it and experiment with it in person. And then going from there and figuring out what works, what lines I could edit a little bit or tweak a little bit to make them feel, you know, just right.
Wait, can I just jump in? I'm so intrigued by this nail polish analogy, layering onto an idea towards a vision. Could we just connect that to your books or your performances? How does that process play out? It's sometimes a little messier for me. I'm like, yeah, I think this is where I'm headed. And then I'll like write a story and I'm like, just kidding. I was totally. Could you just speak more about what that really looks like in practice for you?
Yeah. I mean, who knows if this nail polish metaphor is really going to hold up, but give it a try. I mean, even when you were talking about the mess, you know, I feel like that's also part of it too. Yeah. I'm not a very good nail artist. I actually usually wear press-ons when I do drag because I don't want to deal with the polish. But, you know, for me, part of that process is also wiping away the parts that get on your skin or making little corrections, or maybe if I move away from the nail polish analogy
for a moment.
Just to think about makeup more broadly, you know, I'm definitely one of those queens where like one eyebrow's here and then the other eyebrow's there. And then you have to sort of tweak and tweak and tweak until they kind of meet somewhere in the middle. Not literally, I'm not doing a Frida Kahlo eyebrow, but you know, like till they look like sisters, not cousins. So yeah, I do feel like that is kind of part of my process is it's like both a big and a small idea at the same time, right? Like sometimes it has that hazy big picture feel, or sometimes it has that kind of like, maybe you're just shining the spotlight on one little section and you can't see the whole picture yet. Mm-hmm. I think for me, one of the most exciting and fun and useful things about really theorizing drag and thinking about drag is to think about it as a process of play, right? And to take that invitation to experiment and to improvise and to be open to failure and really take that all to heart, not worry so much I like to get to a finished product, but I think with that, I can sort of trust that it will arrive and I can make it joyful rather than stressful, if that makes sense.
Oh, I love that. I think about polish as a bit stressful because it's final. Like if you're polishing a story, we are getting it to that last gleam, that sheen, and now we're done. But you're describing it like if you're leaning into the theory of drag, the world of drag, but you can't see it that way.
Right.
Just to build off what Caroline said, for people who aren't familiar with the world of drag and what that entails, are you talking the makeup? Are you talking the performance? Are you talking the foundational activism under, you know, I know it's all embedded in there, but I'm just trying to like paint a picture for myself, but also for those who might be listening of a better understanding when we talk about polishing and the mess and working through to figure out where we're really going. Like, what does that really mean?
Oh, it is such a good question. I mean, for me, in many ways, it is all of the above. I think that's what makes drag such a unique and, pleasurable art form, is that it's not one thing. I think different approaches to drag or different takes on drag sometimes focus on the look, or they focus on the performance or any different aspect of it. But I think for me, drag is always this kind of holistic practice that incorporates all these things. Like, it is performance, it is visuals, it is activism, you know, it is humor, it is musicality. It's all these different things all together. And part of that hodgepodge or mishmash is also part of what makes it fun as well.
I love that. Maybe just let's focus on a performance first and then we'll get back into the writing. But when you're coming into a performance, how do you go from visualizing your concept to your arc of your performance and then ultimately to the polish?
Love that.
Ooh, it's so hard to describe in some ways because often it comes really intuitively. For me, it's usually about finding something that's both a little bit of a challenge, but also that amuses me at the same time. I have to sort of chuckle at something or have that little shimmy in my shoulders about it. It's just that little excited, I could do that. Could I do that? Yeah, let me try that kind of feeling. And then it's the problem solving of how to get there and how to build it out. You know, I'm just trying to think back to classic performances that I've done, some of which feel like a million years old. Back in the day, I remember I was doing this performance, well, what then felt like the peak of what we might call rainbow capitalism, although I think in some ways it's only gotten bigger and bigger since then. It was around the time of the It Gets Better campaign starting and just sort of wanting to find a way to critique some of the largesse and the contradictions in mainstreaming queer identities or assimilating queer identities. I immediately thought about what does it mean to take this message of It Gets Better and all these celebrities like offering this kind of empty promise and really blow it up so big that it kind of implodes, right?
Yeah.
And so, of course, I turned to Dolly Parton because she's always such a wonderful vehicle to explore exaggeration, but also internal contradictions. That number became this process of like, how much can I add? I was like, I'm going to have a choir of backup dancers all wearing rainbows. Oh. And then I'm going to twirl a baton. And I borrowed a historic, huge rainbow flag from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Literally from their archives. And it covered the whole stage. And we
wrapped
that up. And I was like, I'm going to badly translate It Gets Better into every language I can find using Google Translate. You know, like I just wanted to like hit people over the head with it. And so that was definitely one approach. It's not always that. Sometimes, you know, you try for something a little more subtle or savvy in its humor. It's still always that process of like, oh, that would be fun. Oh, could I do that? Oh, let me try this thing. I always think of drag as there's some editing, but I think it's usually kind of additive, right? It's all about like putting more and more on, whether that's on your body or into a performance.
There's something really beautiful about just like, we're just going to add. Because sometimes in writing, it's like, what are we cutting? How do we make it tighter? And then sometimes I feel like in the process, you're sort of like, what the F am I doing? Like, I thought this was awesome and this is terrible. And is that a reality for you? When you've got the shimmy and you're working through the thing and you're adding, you've got the rainbows and you've got the choir. And then is there some point in that process where you were like, where am I going with this? Like, what now? And how do you find the track that feels right for you?
Right. I mean, I think honestly, in that performance, it really was more is more. And so maybe in some ways that isn't always the best example or doesn't have the strongest correlation to a writing process. But I think that's part of what makes drag so fun is that it is this practice that can handle that addition and that more is more in ways that, maybe other media or art forms can't. And in some ways, it does make it a challenge for me when it comes back to the writing. to then have to do that editing, right? Mm-hmm. Because I do want every idea in there. I do want to jam pack it with little Easter eggs or little fun things that give me those chuckles. It is a hard process to have to kill your darlings in that way, right? But then I guess in some ways too, it's also nice to know that, like, sure, tomorrow I could do that performance. I can have everything in it I want. So if I have to let go of some things here, I can shove them back in over there or something.
And I feel like, at least for your two picture books that exist now, you bring that energy to them. You're bringing the ethos, the spirit, the more is more to the page. And you feel it, right? The kids, I mean, it's an energy. They feel it. They're dancing. They're moving. You don't feel the edits. You don't feel the tightening. That's all done so artfully. And I feel like there's something there for even stories that don't center drag queens or that don't center the specific art form to find a way to pack in more is more that feels, you know, that works.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is definitely what I wanted kids and grown-up kids to take away from my book so far, is that feeling of more is more, of abundance, of just getting to have it all. I have no training as a children's book author. I really kind of stumbled into this through Drag Story Hour and have been delighted to do so. Sometimes I feel like, I don't know what I'm doing. How am I supposed to be doing this? What are the rules? Even if I want to break them, maybe I should still know them before I start to break them. Yeah. One thing that a friend reminded me early on in the process of writing the books was that the text doesn't have to do everything, and that the illustrations can actually not just fill in, but really add so much and can do a lot of work, especially when you do feel like you need to cut some things out or limit some things. And so I think that that's been one of the most exciting pieces of all these projects, is just getting to work with Olga on bringing that to life visually. Yeah.
I love that you brought that up. And what I've been thinking this whole time is, like, even though the process of writing is a lot of tightening and killing your darlings, but I think what Caroline said is just so beautiful in terms of, like, you bring the life and the energy and the more is more into the story, and you find ways to do that. And you have this incredible advantage of being a performer. Yeah. And picture books are meant to be read out loud.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or older readers. They're meant to be performed in a sense, like read and experienced. I'm really curious how you feel like your understanding of performance impacts how you're writing and how you're thinking about your storytelling in this other form.
I mean, it's totally, totally central to the way that I've approached my first two books. And I'll talk a little bit about my next book as well.
Okay.
But I don't think I can say too much, but I can acknowledge that it's in the works. Like I said, these two really came out of songs that I was already singing with kids, although there was a bit of a process to retranslate them for the page and think about what works when I'm leading it versus what do you need there if I'm not there, if there's not another drag performer there. Kind of organically, I was already performing them before they ever hit the page. But in that process of revision, you know, I literally was standing up in my bedroom next to my desk, like swishing my hips and shouting as queen and things like that, and trying to figure out if that works. Does the rhythm feel right? Does it make sense to group these three verses together versus these other three, you know? And thinking about, like, are these movements that kids can easily do? Are they things that might be challenging? To think a little bit more strategically, especially in the second book where they're kind of grouped into three, each one kind of has a physical movement, some kind of, like, vocalization, just trying to give it a little bit of a pattern in that way. And then my next book, I'll just say, isn't based on a song. And so it didn't kind of come from that same practice of literally working with kids. I had to do a lot more reading aloud just to make sure that it had a solid cadence and flow and would work well as a read aloud. I think it really is all about looking for the things that give me that little feeling of sparkle or that little bit of an internal smile, even if it is the cadence of the text or an unexpected alliteration or rhyme or something that makes it feel a little extra fun.
I think that's something that we, in the children's book space, certainly the author space where you're not thinking about the visuals as much, we can lock ourselves into just language, right? So we're just looking at onomatopoeia, we're just looking at rhythm, whatever it may be. And we lose the experience of reading and talking and moving and looking, your kids staring at you when you're at the exciting part and the hold of a page turn and what that carries. It's a performance. Reading a picture book is a performance.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you just so organically and naturally bring that to the page, it's such a lesson for the rest of us who aren't performing on the weekends or doing Drag Story Hour. So I appreciate that framing, which seems like a nothing burger to you, but it's kind of everything for any of us that work with kids or have kids.
Right. I think part of it for me is the fun because I don't have kids. You know, again, I've sort of stumbled into this work. It still feels like a little bit of discovery to me of thinking, yeah, like you're saying, what does it mean to turn that page? What does it mean to jump ahead a few pages? What is the kid going to focus on in the illustration that isn't what you thought it was, right, but is that tiny little thing that they're obsessed with, or, you know, the character that doesn't have a name and they can't get over that or something like that.
Yes. So
I love those little things.
Anyone who hasn't held these books in your hand, which, what's wrong with you? Go buy them right now. You just can't miss the end papers. You know, like,
yeah,
our kids just gobble up the names, which is so fun because, you know, they haven't had as much experience with drag performances. Now they're getting to recognize the role of puns. What is it pointing towards? What truth is that name, that joke pointing to in the drag queen? And right, of course, it makes me think of Jewish humor too, which I know you're Jewish as well. And this idea,
yes,
of,
yes,
capturing so much of that in just the act of drag.
Those end papers, that was so fun to work on because I hadn't originally planned to give the queen's names just because it wasn't part of the text. And that was something that Olga came up with to make that yearbook feel. And yeah, and it was such a treat and a challenge, but like such a fun challenge to think about, like, how do you create drag names that will not only be appropriate for kids, but that will resonate with kids, right? Yeah. That reference jokes or humor or pop culture references, yeah, or stories that they'll understand. And
what,
yeah,
what on the road as you've read it, like, are there any that are just obvious favorites?
I think Stinkerbell kids usually like. Yeah, I'm trying to think which other ones usually get like a big laugh. I think it's Stinkerbell and Cinderfella, which I think also kind of come at the end, usually when I introduce them all. So
I feel like those two names, actually, we kind of touched on it very briefly earlier, but those names are also intentional. There's a lot of conversation that can come up. I'm super curious how both in your children's books and in your drag performances, when you think about this, these art forms as forms of activism, how do you weave that in different spaces with different art forms and different age groups?
So how do I do it all? No, yeah. it's a big question. It is such a big question. I think it helps in some ways to think about all of these practices somewhat holistically or as a set of intertwining or braided together aspects, but that don't all have to do everything all at once. And in many ways, I resisted letting things come together for a long time. In my quote unquote day job, I'm a professor and my research is more on media and technology, but often through a queer lens. And for a long time, I was like, I don't want that to have anything to do with my drag or my art practice because I want the drag part to feel joyful and not feel burdened or colonized by this overly critical academic way of thinking. But at some point I had to admit that these are all different facets of who I am and the work that I'm doing. I started thinking more critically about drag as it relates to technology, and that really opened up a whole way for me to think about technology in general, not just through drag specifically. I think in some ways it is about allowing these things to find their way into different areas and to trust that they'll each do their own thing in their own time. And as long as I hold on to a little bit of that big picture, I can kind of focus on different things as feels appropriate. But also just say too, it is a fun challenge to also think about audience in this and like, how do I speak to children versus how do I speak to a general population of adult readers versus how do I speak to academics? Those can all be very different kinds of audiences to talk to.
Both in a performance and in a writing context, where's the point when you sit back as the creator and you say, yes, like, I'm ready to share this thought and expression with my audience?
That can be so hard too, because I'm a bit of a perfectionist, even though I want to embrace messiness and failure and all these things. I'm also a Capricorn. I also tend towards wanting to get it right. In that way, doing drag has also just been really helpful to everything that I've done because it is such a messy and often improvisational and often really quick kind of format, at least in the drag scene and the world that I came up in. I was never performing every night or every week or anything like that. But usually each performance was kind of its own thing. And with some exceptions, I would only do a number once. So it was really about at the beginning of the week, if I had a show on a Friday or a Saturday, starting to come up with the idea and put some of the materials together or do a little rehearsing, or maybe honestly doing that like literally in the day or two before In some ways, in that context, things couldn't be too precious. And there was the sense of like, this is the show that I'm going to do. But there weren't drafts. There weren't all these steps along the way. It really just kind of happened quickly. It's more often about reminding myself that even if this is the final version of this thing, that there can always be a next thing, right? Maybe it's not the next children's book. Maybe it's a performance, or maybe it's the academic book that I'm writing, but I always have more opportunities to get to put something out into the world. Yeah. So I think that helps me not worry so much about, is this the perfect version of whatever this thing is going to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I love that so much. You started off the conversation by talking about not being afraid to fail and being messy. There's something really beautiful in that experience, and I'm connecting to improv a little bit, like where you get up and you go. And even though this is a much more polished, sparkly version of that, knowing this is the one time and it's the best with what I did and where I'm at, but it's not that each performance or each work of art isn't in and of itself like the final all-encompassing representation of who you are as a human and who you are as a performer, but that each is just a step along the way. They all feed into the next thing you create in any sphere of your life. That's just
what a liberating thought. Yeah. And it makes me think too, when I talk to people who are just entering the picture book space, and folks, me included, when I started, like kind of really holding one idea very tightly. This is what I'm going to write my book about. This is the thing. And how that can take us away from the wonder and joy and sparkle and of all of volume shooting. Like, okay, it's a new thing. It's a new audience. I'm going to riff. Let's go. Let's build. Yeah. What happens as we go.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that we had a recent conversation where someone described all their old work. You need to release it in order to lean into the future work. I'm hearing that too, which makes me think the universe is speaking through you.
Channeling.
About surrender and joy. There's something here.
Well, yeah. And it's interesting, like thinking about that too. I've written probably 3 or 4 times as many full drafts of books as I have published them. Mm-hmm. And that was also just an interesting process for me too. There's still this one book that I love that I hope someday finds a place to get published, but maybe that wasn't the time for it. Maybe I will sort of have some big epiphany and we'll figure out a way to make it work differently. I know I kept saying, you know, kill your darlings, but maybe it's also just about like letting them take a little nap for a little while and finding that way to come back to certain things later is maybe also a helpful way of not feeling like you have to fully let it go, but giving yourself space from it. And just to continue on that nail polish metaphor from before.
Thank God, we've come back.
You know, we don't paint our nails for life, right? I mean, you strip them, you paint them again. It's all about that constant flow of like, what is my mood today? What am I trying to express today? And that's part of the joy of it as well. It's not about polishing once. It's about constantly polishing and constantly sparkling.
I was obsessed. I'm feeling so, you see me like, my face is like in the
video. I got flushed.
I feel like what is resonating so much is that this idea of polish or revision isn't actually necessarily about one individual. I think that's how I was approaching the question.
This question too?
Yeah, same.
Like individual work of art, a piece of writing or a performance, but that actually this act of polishing and revising is an all-encompassing thing that encompasses all of the different spheres of our lives. And so that every experience provides information or knowledge or inspiration for all the other experiences, that this process of letting our darlings go to sleep is then influenced later as we've grown as humans, so that we can come back with different skills and perspectives to any particular work that we're thinking about.
I think I thought of
in my head.
No, I think I thought of polished as like a bow, you know, like a really a tight bow. And now I'm thinking about it as just like loosely and lovingly holding ribbons in your hand, just like letting it breathe as it will. This is
too many metaphors now.
More metaphors.
Come on. I almost hate to move from this light-filled conversation.
Okay, wait, one last thing before you move.
Please, I don't want to be the one.
Okay, no, don't kill it. I just am thinking about my daughter. Since she was very young, she's 6 now, she's wanted to paint her nails by herself. You know, when she was 2, she'd be like, "Mommy, I do it," you know, and she would just like lather her whole feet.
Right. Full of
like, look, mommy, and she'd be so proud. And there's something about that joy and just like embracing the mess and then loving the process that is, there's no polished metaphors really for me right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that.
Okay, here I come. You can do it here. Everyone just let all the sparkle dump out the door. I'm going to ask. I have to ask how, if at all, the rash of censorship and book banning has impacted your approach to telling and polishing your own stories. Because it's a real force that I think you're uniquely managing. And we're really curious here, one, how you're doing, and then also how it's impacting your heart and your stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a downer, but it is something that we have to contend with and have to talk about. Yeah, it's a bummer. And in some ways, it leaves me speechless because I'm like, it's just so, I just don't know what to say about just how ridiculous.
That's ridiculous, so we have to even talk about it.
Yeah, it's like so absurd. And in some ways, I never expected to be here. And in some ways, since starting this work, I sort of always expected to be here. Oh. I mean, unfortunately, with Drag Story Hour, we had backlash almost since the very beginning. Yeah. And even in some of the bigger cities that we're in, I think we collectively often think about these things as happening in more conservative areas, but they really are happening everywhere, unfortunately. In some ways, just as an individual, I don't know how to situate this in my astrology, but like something about who I am, I'm able to pretty easily absorb a lot of this negativity and kind of brush it off and not let it get to me too much. So I'm glad to be able to kind of offer that to our broader movement and to really let it fuel me and light even more of a fire under me to keep doing the work. I think show business in general has this, the show must go on kind of attitude. Drag has always offered us a place to come together, to commiserate, to find joy in sad or difficult times. I think about drag being one of the few queer visible art forms or expressions during times when people were literally criminalized for being queer, for being trans. Think about drag performers raising money, you know, during the height of the AIDS epidemic, and not just raising money, but really being there for people to tell those off-color jokes, to give people a laugh when they needed it the most. And so in some ways, it's so funny to me that these people are picking a fight with us because they're really telling on themselves. Like they really show that they don't understand what drag is, because drag queens, we have all the tools. The answer to this is more drag, right? Like we spread joy. We read you for a living. It's not even pick on someone your own size. It's like, get a clue about who you're, what kind of bear you're poking, you know? We've got that. A lot of glitter behind us. So yeah. And we know how to use it.
I love coming at it from just such like a calm place of, I know who I am, babe. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like this is on you. Figure out your own stuff.
This goes back to the activism thing we were talking about, but it feels so baked in. It's just such a huge part of drag. Yeah. I was listening to something you posted. I think it was you were reading the Queer Manifesto.
Queer Nation,
like,
yeah.
Like the act of existing and humaning in this world that is so hostile is in and of itself an act of revolution. Mm-hmm. And I feel like drag is such a beautiful example of revolution and joy and sparkle and glitter all together. And I think that's really inspiring. I tend to write really social justice themed books. A lot, some of them can be heavy. And this is a really beautiful example of how to speak and take up space and be fighting for things that matter in this like beautiful, joy-filled, sparkly rainbow way.
Yeah.
So I think that's something I want to really learn from.
I mean, I do have to remind myself as well. I can get heavy. I can get not even necessarily heavy, but I can get really focused and start to lose the joy sometimes when I'm working towards a goal or when, you know, something is really serious. And just having that reminder to step back, to find the joy, to find the humor, and to remember they're not ancillary or they're not extraneous to activism, but that they are integral to it, right? Like we need those things. I mean, I've written a lot about drag as a form of imagination, but I think we need that creativity. We need that, you know, play. We need that imagination to be able to envision where we want to go and what we want the world to look like. So
I think something you do uniquely, just beautifully, is there's so much fear in the space of people who are attacking Drag Story Hour and so much ignorance, but real fear. And I've had the opportunity to read the book to my kids in front of some more conservative folks who would be more unfamiliar with what you do. I imagine the fear coming into it would be you're reading a book that's called If You're a Drag Queen and You Know It. Like, aren't they indoctrinating our kids to be drag queens? Like, okay, hold on. Let's watch what's happening right here. And you're watching these little kids shake their bodies and blow kisses and stomp and shimmy and grin and lean towards books and connect with their parents before bed and light up a room.
Yeah.
And that's what you're fearing. That experience is what you're fearing. Right. But I think you're giving an opportunity for those who are willing to take a beat and breathe and experience it to see what we're actually talking about. What we're talking about is love and connection and activism and community. And so I just thank you for giving that really crystal clear experience in a way that is connected and so love-filled.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate that.
I'm just like, thank you. I'm so moved. I'm gonna come watch all your shows. Where can people find you, actually? Yeah. Like, how can they connect with you?
I would say the best thing is to follow me on social media at Lil Miss Hot Mess. I'm most active on Instagram, although I've been on a little bit of a quiet break for the past month or so. I would say also don't just follow me, but also follow Drag Story Hour at Drag Story Hour on everything. Come to events that happen in your community, or if they don't happen, try to organize them. One of the beauties of Drag Story Hour, just as an idea and an organization and a movement, is that it doesn't really take much. I mean, it does cost a lot to look this cheap, in the words of Dolly Parton, but like really all you need is a drag performer and a place to hold it and some books. Yeah. And it can be pretty simple to put together. My ultimate vision is to have a Drag Story Hour at every library, at every community center, everywhere. And so I think, you know, we have to build it. Yeah.
Okay. So before we wrap though, this is Happy Hour with Spindrift.
Ooh.
Happy Hour with an overshare. So the overshare could be funny, it could be cringy, it could be infuriating, it could be embarrassing, whatever you feel. That's something that's related to your career that you can share with us.
You have time because Joanna's talking to a family member.
Oh, my God. She's farting at me through the window. She had to have a massive surgery on her small intestine. So she's got to like get out of bed and move. But every day it's like, have you passed gas? Have you passed gas? Because that means, you know, it's working. And so she came to the window and like leaned over with her butt to the window. So I would know she was farting.
That is very cute.
I know. For listeners, I'm in a hospital waiting room in Seattle on an emergency trip up to take care of my cousin who had massive surgery straight off a plane last week.
Oof, wow.
But she's farting at me, so she's doing it.
So honestly, it's a good end to that story.
Yeah. That's good. I'm like, can't think of anything that just feels like exciting or oversharing.
You live so authentically.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, it's true. A lot of people have heard a lot of stories. Maybe I should record something and send it to you, because I don't know why I'm so...
I love that. This is actually very exciting from our end. What a thrill. I can't
wait. The pressure is going to continue, but I will think of something to send you for sure.
I love it. This will be the first ever remotely recorded overshare.
Great.
Truly though, thank you so much for doing this. When your first book came out and I saw a blip of it on Publishers Weekly, you know, the announcement, and I reached out to you right away and was like, can I interview you? That was before my first book ever published. So we were debuting around the same time.
Yeah.
And so you were so generous to do that interview and now getting to see your face and do this together and see all the ways your career has shapeshifted. And it's so beautiful. I'm just so grateful to have you here with us.
Oh, thank you. This is such a treat.
Thank you for being here. Seriously, it's been, you know, my mind is like, so glad. I'm looking forward to the overshare.
I know. Okay. Yeah. I will come up with something hopefully good.
Hi again, everyone. Lil Miss Hot Mess did, in fact, send us her overshare later in the evening after our conversation, and it's delightful. We will play the recording here for you now. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for such a lovely and thoughtful conversation, and thank you for giving me a little flexibility when I was having trouble coming up with an overshare. I knew that as soon as we got off the call, some kind of inspiration would strike, and I happened to take a look at the New York Times and read an article about basically how former theater kids run the world, how all these former theater kids are now in various types of prominent positions, whether in politics or media or business or elsewhere. I've talked before about how I was the kind of kid who basically already was a drag queen even before I had the language for it. I was a pretty gender fabulous kid who liked to, like many gay kids, dress up in my mom's high heels and throw a towel over my head and feel glamorous and put on shows in the backyard where I would boss the neighbors around and things like that. So I was also thinking about the first time that I would say that I really, really performed drag, which was in high school. And oddly enough, I was not out yet. I didn't come out until after high school. I considered to be part of the Spice generation, Generation Spice, an elder millennial. We had a burgeoning GSA, but I wasn't quite there yet. However, in junior year, the school was doing a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And the only part that I wanted was Flute the Bellows Mender, who plays the role of Thisbe in the Rude Mechanicals play within the play. And for some reason that year, in addition to doing a monologue, we also had to choreograph some kind of dance or movement. And so given my background in figure skating, which I'm sure listeners will also not be surprised by, I decided to do basically a figure skating routine on rollerblades in this kind of black box theater that had carpet. It was kind of gross. Somehow I survived this whole incident. But it was really, yeah, kind of my first real drag performance, both in the sort of, you know, gender fabulousness in play, but also in conceiving of a number in some of the ways that we're talking about earlier. So I started off doing this kind of Ice Capades style routine to Time After Time, the Cyndi Lauper version. I was wearing, I think, like a tracksuit or something, and I had borrowed my younger brother's oversized Elmo stuffed animal and did this pairs routine, very sentimental, trying to think about the love between Pyramus and Thisbe in this play within a play. And then midway through, in an appropriate way, I suppose, for high school, stripped out of my tracksuit, and underneath I was wearing leopard print, like capri pants, which were big at the time, and a black tank top that I had borrowed from my neighbor. And I must have had some kind of wig, maybe something improvised, maybe not unlike that towel on the head that I mentioned earlier. And I went into Dude Looks Like a Lady and did this kind of saucy performance. But it's kind of funny looking back to think about how, even though I had never seen a drag show, this was before RuPaul's Drag Race, I was underage, I was not out, I wouldn't have known even where to go see a drag show. I guess I knew that drag queens existed, but I don't think I'd even seen, you know, Tu Wong Fu or any of the drag movie classics at that point. Maybe I'd seen Hedwig, maybe. But somehow I guess I intuitively knew how to put together a number and how to bring the drama, how to think about that kind of reveal in the middle. I have a good friend, another drag performer, Phonique, who always talks about how any good drag number needs at least three reveals. And I'm not sure I had three in that performance, but I knew that I needed to have that moment of the reveal. And yeah, needless to say, I did get the part. In fact, as I recall, they wanted to give me what some would consider a better part, a bigger part. But I stuck with my instincts and I wanted to play Thisbe, and I did. And in the final production, I believe I wore a bedsheet as a toga. And yeah, some kind of wig, was probably made out of fabric or something. You know, surprise, surprise, I turned out to be a drag queen. But I guess it's true that theater kids do rule the world.
If you enjoy this podcast, we would be so grateful if you would please take a moment to do any or all of the following things.
Follow or subscribe by tapping on the little plus sign or follow next to Kidlet Happy Hour in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
And while you're there, we would love if you could leave a rating, preferably one with 5 stars, as well as a review.
And don't forget about Patreon, where you can help support production costs, ask us questions, get even more overshares, and receive a delicious thank you treat from JK Chocolate. Check out patreon.com/kidlethappyhourpodcast.
Thank you so much for being here, and we hope to see you back for the next episode.